Business and Labor to order. And I am going to do the works, the two bills at the end of the agenda first. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2255.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2255 is brought to you from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We had hearings on this measure on February 7th and February 26th. The measure makes discrimination against an employee for filing a wage claim or reporting violations of working conditions, minimum wage, and overtime laws an unlawful employment practice. And it also clarifies that compensatory damages are an available remedy. There is no amendment in front of you, and there is no fiscal revenue impact. And you also have in front of you a written testimony of support from the Oregon School Employees Association.
Okay, yes. The good committee administrator said we've had two hearings on this already. We have the department here. Are there any questions or concerns about this? I'll give you a moment to look at it.
Read my notes. I'm ready.
All right. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kristen?
Representative
Edwards.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Estelon.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Mobley. Aye.
Vice Chair Shockley.
Aye.
I'll back it if you want.
Would you like to take that, sure. Representative Escobar? Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2255. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2256.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2256 is also from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It authorizes the use of electronic payment devices such as a pay card for paying wages if the employer and employee both agree to be paid in this fashion. It is the measure establishes criteria and guidelines for allowing the usage of the payment device and allows an employee to revoke the agreement with a 30-day written notice to the employer and allows the Bureau to assess a civil penalty for employers who violate the statute. There you have in front of you a dash two amendment. During the first hearing on the 7th, there were some concerns and questions about some clarification amendments that need to be made. And there was an informal work group established with the representatives from BOLI, the Treasurer's Office, and the Oregon Bankers Association. The dash two amendment is the result of the work group. It clarifies that the electronic payment device must be accessible to the employee at the county where they live or work, and also establishes that an employer can agree to pay wages through an electronic system if the employee can obtain an initial withdrawal of their entire net wages without any cost, or choose to use another means of payment of wages without cost. And there's no revenue or fiscal impact on the measure.
Thank you. I also sat in this nice work group of nice people. I'd like the department and Mr. DeMartinez to come up and just describe the amendments to us and answer any questions that may arise, please. Christy, if you want to go ahead and tell us what we're doing here.
Sure, Sheriff Schaffler and members of the committee. Actually, your committee administrator explained it very well.
As always.
I'm Christine Hammond, administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We actually looked at the language in the current law, which required employers to issue payments that were negotiable in the county where the instrument was issued. And as you pointed out, Chair Schaffler, that could be out of state or in a county, in a remote part of Oregon, or even in another country. And that wouldn't be of much value to an employee if they couldn't cash the check in that county. So we amended the language to make it clear that the instrument should be issued and negotiable in the county where the employee lives or works. And then, as the committee administrator pointed out, the language was just clarified to make it clear that when an electronic payment device is used, that the employee must be able to withdraw the entire amount of net wages to which they are entitled without any fee or charge. So the language simply does that. Have anything to add, Tim?
Mr. Chair, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I agree with everything that's been said today, and thank you for your leadership in bringing the work group together.
And for my part, Mr. Chair, Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, I'm glad we could all come together on this particular bill and amendment, and look forward to your passage of it.
Are there any questions?
All right. Well, thank you very much. Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2256.
Representative Rosenbaum moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2256. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? And so ruled. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2256 to the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kristen?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Obama.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Obama. Aye.
Aye.
Is there a volunteer to carry this bill? Representative Smith?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're
all right, then. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2256 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2537.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2537 prohibits employees of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus systems from striking or recognizing the picket line of a labor organization while performing official duties. You have in front of you a dash 1 amendment that was brought to you by TriMet. It was observed that the current version of the bill, the statute that's being utilized, is also the same statute being used in Senate Bill 400, which is on the floor on Wednesday. So what the amendment will do is actually create a new statute within collective bargaining laws.
Thank you. I'm going to call John Hunt and Jim Markey first, please. Whichever one of you gentlemen wants to go first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity of testifying today. I'm Jim Markey, today representing Amalgamated Transit Union. I have with me John Hunt, the president of Amalgamated Transit Union 757. That union represents employees of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus systems throughout Oregon. They include TriMet, Salem Chariots, Lane County Transit District, Rogue Valley Transit District, Corvallis Bus System, and others. The union requested the introduction of House Bill 2537, and this bill would actually prohibit our membership from striking any of the properties where we represent employees of these districts. And instead of that, these labor disputes, where they couldn't otherwise be resolved, would be resolved through binding arbitration, as other safety employees are done. It has been our experience over the many, many years that I've represented this union that we hadn't had a strike in Oregon until last year. We had one in Lane County. It was ugly. And I think Representative Holvey could attest to the ugliness of that little endeavor down there. We believe that strikes are just a no-win situation, and we believe that binding arbitration is a much better way to resolve these kinds of disputes. The union, the international union that we're affiliated with, in its charter and bylaws, requires us to seek arbitration prior to a strike, and we've always endeavored to do that. Further, the federal agreements that are signed with transit districts in return for federal dollars used to require that the districts submit to binding arbitration if requested to do so by the union. That is not the case anymore, so the districts would not simply have to agree to do that if we requested it. I think that everyone could understand that if we had a strike, particularly in Portland, with TriMet, and that system was shut down for days or weeks, we would have chaos up there, and simply would not be a good situation. Under the present statutes of Oregon, with the way in which binding arbitration is done for these type of employees, is last best offer. Both parties submit one last final best offer, and the arbitrator has to choose between the two. I think that is a good system because it forces people to get real and forces them to the center, and you don't have folks out there in La La Land. With that, I will finish. I'll be happy to answer any questions. I believe that Mr. Hunt has submitted some written testimony and would like to make a brief statement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, ever since the founding of ATU, we have
Mr. Hunt, you got to identify yourself.
Jonathan Hunt, thank President, you, Business Representative, Amalgamated Transit Union, Division 757. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, ever since the founding of ATU, we have sought to use binding arbitration to resolve disputes over the term to be included in the new labor contract. Today, ATU continues to advocate arbitration as a preferred method to resolving disputes between our local and their employees' companies. ATU local unions are required under our Constitution and general laws to offer interest arbitration before international will authorize a strike. This policy is designed to limit the number of work stoppages in the transit industry. It has been quite successful over the years. More than 97% of our contract negotiations in recent years have been settled without a strike. While some do not grant public employee collective bargaining rights, others do provide such rights in their statutes. Some of these state statutes addressed binding arbitration procedures in general. Others specifically address arbitration procedures in the transit industry. The statutes attached in the handouts are only samples of these transit-specific provisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of these gentlemen? Well, you're right. Strike is absolutely the worst thing for both parties. I couldn't agree more. It's a last resort for everybody. Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe not a question, but just a comment, because we did have a strike in Lane County, and, I guess I didn't really realize how important mass transit, I always knew it was important, but, because I got a lot of people contacting me from the disabled community, employers contacting me. It really has a pretty widespread effect on people's lives, their day-to-day, their doctor's appointments, employers, jobs, and our local economy. And so I'm going to be supporting this bill if it continues to go forward, because it really is, mass transit is really important to us, and I don't think it's in anybody's interest to see it stopped.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, would you like us to address the Dash 1 amendments at this time?
That would be great.
I did take the time to discuss these amendments with Olivia Clark, lobbyist for TriMet, and my understanding that these were at the request of TriMet and that they had a concern about our employees coming under the provisions of Senate Bill 400. Mandatory bargaining for safety issues and staff levels. I have told Olivia that, and Olivia says that, I believe that my understanding was that with these amendments, that TriMet would be neutral on this bill, and it was never our intention to get in the way of Senate Bill 400 or to be a part of, that wasn't our bill.
That's good.
It's not what we were after. And we would welcome these amendments if that brought TriMet to a position of neutrality. I haven't had an opportunity, because I just got the amendments, and I haven't had an opportunity to run these amendments through our legal staff, and I would like the opportunity to do that before we could argue about the words, but I do know what the intent is, and we would certainly support that intent. So,
well, I have Ms. Clark on. She's going to be the last one up here today on this bill, I believe, and we're not moving anything today, but thank you for that. Are there any more questions? Representative Berger.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Markey, for your the Dash 1 amendments. I think were important to some of us that it be clarified, and I appreciate you having a good look at them, because I think they encourage my support of this bill.
That's what we try to do around here. Alrighty then. If there are no more questions,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like Roger Martin, Kelly Scannell Brooks, and Mary Adams, please. Roger, go ahead if you're the first one to sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Roger Martin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association. And we oppose this bill. I've been in politics longer than anybody in this room, so I understand our opposition is probably not going to sway very many people. But I want to give you some of the reasons why, and I'd like you to take a look at it. The original, first of all, this statute, I was a member of the legislature when we wrote this statute on transit districts and transportation districts. At the time, the only representative and the labor, the only representative from outside, the lobbyist, sole lobbyist for transit was Mel Schopert, who was the original president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. And at the point he was asked, what do you want the ultimate tool to be in a labor negotiation? He said the right to strike. Now, obviously, the ATU has changed since then. But it was written 40 years ago, and it has worked. This has worked. We've had one strike, and it may have been contentious, but it was settled relatively quickly. We've had earnest negotiations. I talked today to one of the leading labor, management labor lawyers in the state of Oregon. He says, be my prediction that from now until the next session of the legislature, you won't have one labor negotiation settled, because it'll always be in the interest of the union to go to arbitration. We're just going to go straight to arbitration to try to settle these things. If you look at Section 1 of the bill, Sub 1, the current law covers mainly first responders, people, emergency workers, police, fire, prison guards, people that are really in key positions where we simply cannot have a strike. We're adding to that employees of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus system. Employee means more than just driver. Employee is going to cover clerical staff, going to cover everybody that is under the union contract. And I don't think there's a real good argument for the need for covering all of those. I'm very concerned for the smaller systems in the state of Oregon. And I want to refer specifically to Rogue Valley Transportation District. The vice chairman is familiar with the desperate-ish situation they're currently in. They've had a series of very contentious labor negotiations that have been very difficult. They don't have the money to fund the organization the way it is. This is just going to be one more problem for them. I'll go back to one point. The system has worked for 40 years. You're dealing not with a union that is one of the lowest paid unions in the state. TriMet's health program, negotiated with the ATU, is as good as any health program of any public employee union in the state. So they don't lose at the bargaining table. And I'm just saying you're going to unbalance the balance that exists now. And every one of the employers you're talking about are public employees, public employers using taxpayers' money. And I think we're going to unbalance that system if you go forward with this bill. I do recommend that you consider the amendment that Olivia is going to offer in a few moments. But I'd like you to take a deep breath and think about, do you really need to do this? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My pleasure, sir. Okay, go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Scannell Brooks, and I'm here today on behalf of Lane Transit District. And with me is Mary Adams, who is the Director of Human Resources and Risk Management for the district. And I'm here for two reasons. The first one is to let you know that Lane Transit District is taking no position on this bill. The second is because I knew we'd come up today to be a resource to you all and to share just a little bit of background on the 2005 strike and answer any questions that y'all have for us. So you might ask yourself, how can the only transit district in the state that has a strike not take a position on this bill, which is a good question. But right now, we are actually just about to go into contract negotiations. Those will begin in April and with ATU. And really the utmost importance to the district and the board is that we start off those discussions on a good foot, that we have positive conversations, and fighting with each other in Salem may not be the best way to do that. So it's not that they haven't had discussions about it, that there might be some issues of concern. It's just right now it's not the right thing for the transit district to do. So that's the reason for the no position. Just for a little bit of background, you've already heard we've had one strike in the 35-year history. It lasted for a week. The fixed route system was completely stopped. But the paratransit system, RideSource, which serves the elderly and disabled community, did operate during that week. And the community did get very involved and resolved it relatively quickly. So that's really it. Mary's the smart person on all this, so she'll answer any technical questions that you have. But that's my prepared remarks.
Do you have anything to add to that right now? Maybe any questions of our friends here today? All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And Mr. Martin, thank you for your service the last 40 years. It's greatly appreciated. All right. Olivia Clark, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet here today. Frankly, I had not intended to testify. I was going to submit written testimony until I looked a little more closely at this bill and its relationship to Senate Bill 400. It was then that we became rather concerned about the bill, and you've heard about the amendment. I'm not sure you have the amendment. If it's been distributed, it has. And it's basically identical to 2537. It just put a different statute just to simply remove the transit workers from the provisions of Senate Bill 400. That's all it does. I think I've been quoted up here a couple of times. But if we can amend that bill, the TriMet will be neutral on 2537.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Olivia. Have a nice evening. Anyone else like to testify to House Bill 2537 today? All right. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2537. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2744.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2744 is sponsored by Representative Flores at the request of Susan and Jim McLaren. It allows patrons of an establishment that holds a winery license to make wine if winemaking is conducted under the direct supervision of the licensee or its employees. And there's no fiscal or revenue impact on the measure.
Thank you. Jim McLaren, please. I thought I recognized you there, Mr. McLaren.
This is my resident
in my office last week, and I go, where did I see that guy? Go ahead, if you're ready.
Okay, just a few brief words. Thank you for listening and considering this bill. I'm representing my wife today, Susan, who's unable to attend because of the demands of her job at a Portland medical clinic. She is as...
Oh, excuse me. Did you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. Jim McLaren.
Now you're ready to go. Forgive me for not getting
earlier. My wife's asking for a change in ORS 471-403, subsection 1. HB 2744 would, as you said, allow customers to make wine in a shop that she would open through Vintner's Cellars, which is a Michigan-based franchise company. They have stores now in 17 states. One is pending also in Washington State. Under 2744, customers would be able to make wine in the store under the direct supervision of the proprietor. They would not be able to sell it nor consume it on the property. The store is similar to the so-called U-brews, which are currently allowed under Oregon law. And Susan figured that since Oregonians are such do-it-yourselfers, they'd really appreciate the opportunity to be able to do this. Kind of a wine 101 class for people wanting to learn more about wine and the chance to be a winemaker for people who love wine. So, again, thank you for your consideration. And if there's any questions...
Well, I'd like this to pass because then we won't have to argue about whether you ship it or not or where it's shipped from or who buys it. They can just go make their own and ship it back to their house. There's some other bills. But are there any questions of Mr. McLaren here today? Representative Holvey.
I'm just sort of curious if you can shed any light when Oregon passed the statute to allow U-brew facilities, why wine was left out.
It was my understanding when that was passed, I talked to some people at the OLCC, that wine wasn't as big an issue then as was beer, and then wine just wasn't considered at the time.
Interesting.
Any other questions?
Representative Berger. Mr. Chair, when I had talked to Mr. McLaren about this bill at an earlier time, I asked if you had the 3 p.m. vintage, if that's how it worked, and he avowed that that's not exactly how it works.
No.
And I think I'm fine with this concept.
I think it's a great idea. There are U-brews out there. It's just people that are interested in this are going to be doing this. And
true.
More power to you. Any more questions of Mr. McLaren? Thank you, sir. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2744. And I would just soon move this out right now, if it's okay with you folks. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House...
Wait a second. I open a work session on House Bill 2744. Representative
Well, in
Berger.
That case, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2744 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2744 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, Kristen, please, would you call?
Aye.
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 Aye. Representative Berger, would you like to carry this
I'd
on the floor?
I'd love to.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session. Thank you, Mr. McLaren, for bringing that to our attention, and good luck.
Thank you.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2941.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2941 removes the current requirement that motor vehicles be subject to enforcement of express manufacturer's warranties be sold in the state. It also changes the time frame for a motor vehicle seller to send a buyer the notice that the lender has not approved financing for the buyer's motor vehicle transaction and to return the items of value received for the purchase or lease from within 20 days to 14 days. It also shortens the time frame a seller is permitted to charge a buyer a reasonable rate for the buyer's usage of the vehicle before the lender was denied financing to the buyer from 20 days to 14 days.
All right, Tom Gallagher, Greg Remsberger, and Daryl Fuller. You might as well come on right up now, Daryl. That's all the three I have signed up. And the first one to sit down gets to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, and I'd like to introduce Daryl Fuller to go first. Mr. Chair, I represent the Oregon Association of Auto Dealers, and this is our bill. I had a nice presentation put together to give you, but I just read the Department of Justice memorandum on it, and it says everything I was going to say much more succinctly. So let me quote from their memo, which says that Section 1 of the bill eliminates the language that is sold in this state. And what that means is if you buy a car out of state and register it in Oregon, with that language in there, you're not covered by the Lemon Law. You can't go but take the car back to the dealer and eventually unwind the deal if the dealer can't fix the car. So we're proposing to take that out on behalf of the consumer so that when you buy the car out of state and register it in Oregon, you're completely covered by the manufacturer warranty. Checked with both the representatives of the national manufacturers and of GM, and they're both fine with that amendment. So that's Section 1. Section 2 is a little bit more complicated, but not too much. Right now, there's a statute that covers Oregon auto dealers that says that you have to take care, when you take a car in trade, you have to take care of that car and pay off all the security interest in that car within 15 days so that the consumer, the record of the consumer, the credit record of the consumer is not impaired because you're holding the car. So there's a 15-day statutory timeline in the statute right now. The problem arises sometimes when the consumer comes in and goes through a credit check and he's okay under the credit check, but you file for credit for the consumer and it doesn't go through. And so you try a different lending organization, you may try two or three. You're holding the consumer's car, he's driven off in the new car, but you're not able to finish the deal because you can't get financing. There's no timeline on that right now in Oregon statute. There is a timeline that says that you have to pay off the interest, the security interest, in 15 days. So we have proposed in this bill that the auto dealers have 14 days to make that deal good, to get the financing for the consumer, or the deal is completely undone and unwound. The consumer gets their car back and any monies they paid down, and the auto dealer gets their car back, and you have to start fresh and make another deal. So this goes to the protection of the dealer and the consumer when you have a place where you thought you could get the financing falls through, and the car deal becomes undoable. So I brought with me Greg Remsberger, who's the director of the association, and we're happy to answer any questions if you have them on this bill.
Greg, do you have anything to add before I go to Daryl here?
Greg Remsberger, I'm the executive vice president of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Tom pretty much summed it up.
Mm-hmm.
It requires that the dealers, on the second phase, it requires that the dealers get irrevocable credit established within that 14-day time limit, which means before that 15th day of having to satisfy the financial obligation of the vehicle they took in trade is done, the deal has to be completed. So we think it's good for the consumers. We think it's good for the dealerships, and we ask that the bill with the amendments mentioned get moved forward.
Okay, I want to remind everybody to shut your phones off.
Chair Schauffele, that was not my phone.
It wasn't mine either. Daryl, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller with the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. I just want to indicate that we've looked at the bill and we supported it as well. Thank you.
That's what I wanted to hear. Everybody's happy. Any questions of these fine gentlemen today? Representative Berger.
I guess I can see pretty clearly how it would help you guys. Explain just a little bit more how it helps the consumers, particularly the Section 2.
Chair Schauffele, Representative Berger. How it protects the consumer is if this gets strung on for a long period of time, and once it gets past those 15 days, the dealership has to pay off the vehicle, which they do. Then if for some reason on the 16th day or further, they decide a deal can't be financed, they need to walk away from it, now the dealer owns the consumer's vehicle technically, but not in title, and so they have to resell the vehicle that they have back to the dealer in a sense. So this just puts a guideline on it that says the dealer who has the obligation to complete the deal, when he let the consumer drive off his lot in his vehicle and took his other one in the trade, there's a agreement that's signed that the consumer will submit the stipulations required to get them financing, and the dealer will do everything they can to complete the deal. And this just puts a excuse me, a timeline on it so that it's all wrapped up within that
follow
time frame.
Yes, ma'am. And this stipulation will include notification of this timeline?
Yes.
I guess that's what I'm most concerned with. People are always coming up with, well, the computer was down, I didn't get to DMV in time. I mean, you could hear a thousand reasons why this is too tight a timeline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, what we've been saying very kindly and gently is most of the time this is because the credit application was filled out fraudulently or inaccurately. So the dealer does have to go through all of their work. But oftentimes you have, in this case, a car which, to make the deal work, you paid more money for than it's worth in the market. And the reason you did that is to make both ends of the deal work. So what happens when the consumer wants to unwind their end of the deal but not the other?
I understand.
Representative Hovey.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to follow along with this. It appears to me that this bill is giving the lender 14 days to back out of a transaction to buy an automobile.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Hovey, I don't think it's the lender at all. I think the when you submit the credit application to one of the mortgage companies, they very quickly get back to you and say yes or no. In this case, where you go in and somebody lender turns you down, you try another lender, you even consider financing it yourself, there may be a series of transactions where you're trying to shore up the credit of the person, get records or data, or talk a different finance company into covering it. So it's not the finance company that has 14 days to under the deal. They're fairly quick on it.
So it's the seller that...
It's the seller trying hard to get credit established for the buyer.
And sometimes it falls into the classification of the stipulations that were required of the purchaser are not met in order for the dealer to consummate the deal. So this puts a little bit of heat under the consumer's feet to get the information that's required, or the deal just walks away.
Okay, that clarifies it. Thank you.
Any other questions, these gentlemen? All right, it's just the first public hearing. I want you to all go around to the whole committee and make sure everybody's comfortable with this. We're not going to move it today because it's just the first one.
There's a couple of you I haven't seen yet. I'd be happy to do
that. That's great. I'd appreciate that. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2941. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 194.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 194 is pre-session filed on behalf of the Employment Department. It expands the circumstances under which the Director of the Employment Department may consider reconsider determination of employer subjectivity tax rate or a tax assessment by allowing the director to reconsider the determination if it resulted from misinformation provided by the department, facts that were not previously known to the department, or errors that were caused by the misapplication of law. There was no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact, and it passed unanimously both out of the Senate Commerce Committee and the Senate.
Thank you. We have the department here on both these bills, so when we're done with this one, don't get up. Just stay right where you are, please. Go ahead and tell us what we're doing here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Edwards. I'm the tax manager for the Employment Department. I'm here to just give you a little information about Senate Bill 194. Currently, unemployment insurance benefit cases, there's five reasons that they can be reconsidered by the director. However, tax cases only have three reasons. So what we're trying to do here is expand the director's authority so those additional two reasons are also applicable to tax cases. The two reasons are that misinformation was provided to a party by the department or misapplication of the law by the department. We estimate we will use this very rarely. Our benefits section uses it 2 to 3 times a year to question decisions by the Office of Administrative Hearings. I doubt that the tax section would use it even that much. It's possible. Every time we have a hearing decision that we disagree with and we have to appeal to the Court of Appeals, it costs us a minimum of $5,000 in Attorney General costs, so we think we would have some savings there. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions of Mr. Edwards today? Representative Berger.
Basically restated, this is sort of a safety valve for small errors that allows you not to go through the full proceedings. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I would characterize that as exactly correct.
Thank you.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this bill is a good idea. Just my own experience, I've been really shocked sometimes by a tax rate that gets levied against me when I employ a couple of people for campaign purposes, and my accountant goes, God, why? I don't know why they're charging such a high tax rate. And I've never really asked the unemployment insurance people why I'm getting charged such a high tax rate, but there's got to be an error there, I'm pretty sure. And so this bill would actually allow the director to change that.
Chair, members of the committee, Tom Byerly, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance. I'm going to take Mr. Edwards out behind the woodshed and make sure this gets fixed.
Right. Are there any? I'm sure my tax bills are high, too high, too.
I know.
Look it up.
Are there any more questions of these fine gentlemen on this bill? All right, then. Don't go anywhere, guys. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 194. And does the committee feel comfortable working this? Okay, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 194. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 194 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye. Representative Holby, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
You already got one today, right?
Yeah, that's right. I do.
Very good. I'm going to close the session on House Bill 194, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 196.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, I close the work session on Senate Bill 194. Open us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance with the Employment Department. I'm here to offer some testimony on Senate Bill 196. You have some written testimony before you, I believe. Should I launch into my testimony, or should we allow the administrator
go
to
ahead,
talk
Teresa.
A little bit?
Go ahead, Teresa.
Okay.
Skipped right over
didn't
you.
Right. We're
doing
it's at the discretion of you, Mr. Chair. It's fine. Senate Bill 196 extends the penalties for an individual who is caught fraudulently taking unemployment insurance benefits. Currently, the maximum penalty period is 26 weeks served over a three-year period. Under the measure, it's extended to 52 weeks served over a five-year period. And the director of the Employment Department can also assess a penalty of up to 15% of the untitled benefits.
Very good. Mr. Byerly, you want to add anything to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little additional background. The intent of this bill is to further
deter the incidence of unemployment insurance fraud. We want to make sure those that are maybe thinking about committing fraud understand and see a little bit stiffer penalties than they have in the past. Under current law, we can penalize somebody for 26 weeks of benefits for being fraudulent. In other words, they would have to claim a week of benefits for 26 weeks, just like they were going to get an unemployment insurance check, but they don't, and that's the penalty that they would serve. This bill would serve to double that penalty to 52 weeks or 1 year. It also extends the period that you would have to sign off or claim against that penalty from 3 to 5 years. It would also add, as Teresa indicated, a penalty of up to 15% of the amount of benefits that you received that, to which you were not entitled. So you would have a penalty to pay back, a monetary penalty, in addition to the overpaid benefits that you would have to return to the trust fund. We're hoping and thinking that this will further deter incidents of fraud and help us keep unemployment insurance tax rates down and keep the integrity of the trust fund strong.
What's the degree of fraud right now in unemployment?
We estimate it's about 2.5% of all the unemployment claims, all the weeks of unemployment claimed are fraudulent or are overpaid.
And what's that compared to other states?
Do you have any idea? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't have that number immediately, but I could sure get that for you.
Yeah, no, I just out of curiosity, I'd be interested in finding out. Yes, sir, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, and how would you determine overpayment? I mean, that would be a clerical error on the part of the unemployment department or the employment department, not necessarily the individual.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Esquivel, that's not necessarily true. What this is aimed at are those that were working under the table and not reporting their earnings to us and claiming unemployment insurance at the same time. So they are actually getting benefits to which they're not entitled because they were working. So the overpayment comes from them not telling us about their work and earnings. So they're actually cheating, to be really blunt.
Well, that's fine. We like that kind of language.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Is that why they call it fraud? I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Esquivel, that's why they call it fraud.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, gentlemen, I'd like to pursue the chair's line of questioning because there's nothing in here that indicates to me that we have a significant problem, and I don't know whether 2.5% fraud rate is going up or going down. I guess I'm wondering, do we have a problem that this solves, and has it been articulated in some way that I can understand? I mean, I understand fraud is a problem, and I understand these are pretty punishing things. However, I always worry that somebody's going to get caught in a net more for stupidity than fraud, and a year is a long time and a pretty stiff penalty. So I guess, Is there an ongoing issue of fraud that you are seeing that you think this is the solution to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is an excellent question. And while I can't compare the percentage of fraud of other states to Oregon right off the top of my head, I can provide some other numbers. Since 1997, when we had a Secretary of State audit of our benefit overpayments and collections, we have been trying to step up and figure out ways to not only deter benefit fraud, but to collect it more quickly. Over the past few years, our account receivables for overpaid benefits exceeded $30 million. Thanks to some really good efforts on our staff, we've actually got that under $30 million. We're collecting over $1 million a year now in overpayments. What we've done since 1997 is we instilled interest on the overpayments. That slowed some of it down. We've also stepped up and have a new cross-match where we take the employer reports that come into us quarterly and compare those to the claims. We totally revise that system to try to deter this fraud. Getting back to someone who could possibly be caught in a mistake, this is only aimed at those that willfully commit fraud. In other words, it's a pretty high standard. We have three standards of overpayments for unemployment insurance benefits. The first one I'll talk about is the type F for the fraud, where you willfully misrepresent facts. You say, I did not work when you did. I was available for work when maybe you were on vacation somewhere having a good time. We have then an A-type overpayment where, irrespective of your knowledge or intent, you weren't really fraudulent. Let's say You reported on your claim your net earnings rather than your gross earnings. That causes an overpayment. We ask for that money back. We don't penalize them for fraud, however. Then we have the B-type overpayments, which are mistakes that we make as a department. In other words, we determined your claim too high, and turns out that you got money that you weren't supposed to get, so we ask for that back. We don't even ask for that back in cash. We ask that to be offset on future benefits, and then we waive it after a year. Another example would be if somebody was paid by a claims adjudicator at the first level eligibility determination, and then it goes to a hearing and the employer appeals, and that decision is overturned. That, again, is a B-type overpayment. It's not the claimant's fault, so we don't go after them with these penalties or anything like that. Again, this is just strictly for those that are willfully misrepresenting facts to obtain benefits.
So you got to make a conscious effort to get caught up in this. Knowingly know you're defrauding your department of this money.
Mr. Chair, that's a very good characterization. And we do not put these penalties on people without interviewing them and find out what their knowledge or intent was before they defrauded the system.
Mr. Chair, can I have one more follow-up? And the type A is the payback with interest?
The type A would require some interest, right.
Okay.
But no penalties.
How frequently does someone get disqualified for 52 weeks in those type A cases?
Well, in a type A case, we don't disqualify them for 52 weeks.
Oh, forgive me.
And right now it's a maximum of 26 weeks. It's the fraud cases that we would apply
okay.
for 52 week
penalties. A is a step down from fraud, and right. then there's a B.
I don't know the incidence of fraud cases that we determine the maximum penalty, but I could get that information for you as well.
How frequently that happens.
Right.
Representative Edwards.
Cracking down on fraud. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Cracking down on fraud is obviously a good thing. I question whether or not somebody who is, for lack of a better word, stupid enough to try to defraud the system is actually going to go to the length to really understand the penalties. I mean, you're claiming a deterrent effect, and I'm wondering, well, is simply having a requirement or, you know, adding this to the statute really going to be a deterrent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, with 25-plus years of experience in the system, I see word of mouth being our best deterrent. A lot of individuals have friends that work in the same union, the same company, the same whatever. They share what's going on in unemployment insurance. Sometimes they know it better than us. And when they hear of somebody who is penalized for fraud, they will get the idea that maybe they shouldn't do that either. We also publicize in the papers whenever possible when we prosecute somebody for unemployment insurance fraud. And we would also put it in, we have a handbook that we give to all of our customers that file an unemployment insurance claim that describes the penalties for fraud, and that would be in there for them to read anytime they file a claim.
Yep, go ahead.
Another question, different line of questioning. What's the process for determining guilt, and then also what would be because we're talking about outright fraud. So what's the investigation process look like, and what's the appeals process look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, great question. Thank you. We would once we get a tip or we get a letter from an employer that said this individual worked, and we find out that they claimed unemployment insurance at the same time, we mail them a letter. And that letter breaks down week by week what the earnings they reported versus the earnings the employer reported. We then ask them to contact us by phone, and often if it's a significant overpayment, we prefer to have them come in for an in-person interview. And we go over those weeks and offer that they could bring check stubs to dispute the findings or any other information that they want to bring in to dispute those findings. And we ask them simply, when you filed your claim for benefits this week and the question asked, during this week, did you work? And you said no, yet your employer says you earned $450, what exactly was going through your mind at that time? Basically, from that, you can conclude that, well, they probably knew what they were doing. And often they say, you know, I just thought I could get away with it, so I needed the extra money. That's how we determine the willfulness. Did I answer your question adequately?
No.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if some, you mentioned people being paid under the table. If people are being paid under the table, then somebody's paying them illegally too, right?
That's correct.
So what's happening to the other end of that transaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's when my good friend Mr. Edwards here, the tax manager, comes into play, and we will send an auditor out to review that employer's books to find out if they're maybe not paying unemployment taxes on an employee that they should be.
And what's the penalty? I'm sorry, follow that's up, okay, Mr. Chair. And what is the penalty then if you find out that they have been doing that?
To the employer?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, could I just ask Mr. Edwards to respond to that since he's here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the penalty to an employer will vary with the severity of the case. At minimum, what's going to happen is we're going to pick what we
Mr. Edwards, apparently you have to, you're in a different bill now, so you have to.
Oh, sorry. Very good. Thank you.
Tell us where you are again.
Right,
we forgot.
For the record, Rob Edwards, tax manager for the Employment Division. Department, sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum.
Yeah.
The penalty will vary depending on the severity of the incident. At the minimum, what will happen is we will pick up the wages. That is, we will take the wages that we found in the audit, make them taxable, and the employer will have to pay interest of 18% per year from the period when the tax should have been paid to the present time. Plus, if they don't pay it within 20 days, they'll get an additional 10% penalty. As you may well imagine, cash under the table or the underground economy is probably the hardest thing for us to discover and pursue. If someone really doesn't want to be caught, and if employer is truly operating on a cash basis, it is very difficult for us to discover and very difficult to get any sort of resolution. Most of the time, people who say they're paying cash actually are leaving some sort of a trail. There may be withdrawals from their bank account that they can't satisfactorily explain to us. Strangely enough, one of the things that we will see is employers who pay cash will take that deduction on their corporate or income tax returns as a deduction, which is always very revealing to us to say, here's amounts that you declared as wages on your one tax but didn't bother to report on the other tax where you'd have to pay. So depending on the level of sophistication of the employer, it is possible to avoid it, but we're doing our best to try and put a stop to it.
Any further questions? Representative Holby?
Yeah, I just have one. Is there any increased penalty or I guess for somebody who's a repeat offender of this particular fraud, or is 52 or currently 26 weeks it no matter what?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Holvey, right now 26 weeks is it. I would, to be honest, we have contemplated a three strikes and you're out kind of a penalty, but we have not gone to that length yet. Our intent is with the additional 26 weeks that is going to deter somebody from coming back so quickly, and it almost has the same effect as maybe increasing the penalty. I know we do have repeat offenders where they may have misrepresented facts on 1 or 2 weeks of their claim and then come back again because they did get away with it. And while they may have gotten 4 weeks at one point, then we increase it to the full 26 to try to get their attention.
You know, gentlemen, there's enough questions on this. I'd like you to spend some time with the committee, and then we'll bring this back again. I'm confident we can work this bill out of here, but I'd just like you to spend time with everyone up here, square them away, answer all their questions. If they have any questions, get back to them on it, and then we'll bring it back. I think that's probably the best way.
Glad to, Mr. Chair, because I did neglect to answer one of Representative Edwards.
If you have the answer for him right now.
Well, they asked about the appeal process, and once we issued an administrative decision on overpayment, I apologize. I got so flustered up here, I forgot. We do have an appeal period. When an administrative decision is issued, the claimant who gets the decision has 20 days to appeal that decision to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And they go before an administrative law judge and tell their side of the story, and the administrative law judge then does a de novo review of the facts and makes their own determination on the appropriateness of the penalty. Sometimes they'll increase the penalty, sometimes they'll reduce the penalty, sometimes they'll wipe out the penalty. They don't see the willful nature of it. And from the Employment Appeals Board, from the Office of Administrative Hearings, they have 20 days to appeal that to the Office of, the Employment Appeals Board. So they have two levels of administrative appeal that doesn't cost the appellate any money.
All right, I'm confident you can go out and do work,
make an appointment with all these nice people,
okay,
get them to feel happy, and then we'll move this bill. I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 196. Pretty good is the order. Does anyone on the committee have anything to add today? Very good. I'm going to close, or I'll stand.